Welcome to the show that gets Christians thinking about faith and politics. Get ready to challenge the status quo, expand your imagination, and tackle controversy head on. Let's stand together at the intersection of faith and freedom. It's time for the Libertarian Christian Podcast.
Welcome to another episode of Libertarian Christian Podcast, a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute. I'm your host, Cody Cook, and my guest is Jason Porterfield. Jason has a master's in theology from Fuller Theological Seminary. He's worked with Servants, which is an international network of Christian communities living and ministering among the urban poor. And he's the author of Fight Like Jesus, How Jesus Waged Peace Throughout Holy Week. It's that latter credit that we'll be focusing on today. Thanks for being here, Jason.
Yeah, Cody, thanks for the invitation.
Absolutely. Well, what the listeners don't know is that this is actually my second invitation and our second interview. We had a whole conversation about this book, but due to some technical issues, we weren't able to release it. However, I thought that our audience would really appreciate Fight Like Jesus, and I wanted them to hear about it, to know about it. So I asked if you'd be willing to give it another shot, and I thank you for taking even more time out of your schedule to talk with me again.
You bet.
So in your book, Fight Like Jesus, basically, I'll try to sum it up as I saw it. It's trying to answer this question of how Jesus made peace by zeroing in on Holy Week. And so that's that last week of Jesus's earthly life leading up to the crucifixion and the resurrection. It starts with Palm Sunday. And so that's maybe where we'll start. So you talk about the triumphal entry on that day where he's sort of coming in, there's the palm branches and the donkey and whatnot. And that's something that we do, think about and talk about during Holy Week. If you've got kids who, if you're a part of a church that has like sort of a kid's Sunday school, that they'll probably reenact that scene.
Yep.
And we talk about the triumphal entry on that day, kind of the positive stuff, the good stuff, the king's coming stuff. But we largely ignore Jesus's lament over Jerusalem, which also happens on that day. And you argue that that's actually central to understanding Holy Week. That's kind of where you start. So why is that? Why is that so important?
Yeah, great synopsis and good question. Maybe I'll back up and say, I didn't always think of this lament as Jesus is coming down the Mount of Olives, crossing the Kidron Valley, looking at Jerusalem with the temple front and center, right? I didn't always think of that lament where he cries out, "If only you knew on this of all days the things that make for peace." It wasn't until more recently that I saw that as being central to understanding Jesus's final days. If I could back up, in college, I went to a Christian college called Messiah University, and a couple of weeks into my freshman year, 9/11 happened, and that event proved extremely formative for the next 4 years of my life. As collectively, as a student body, we grappled with what does it mean to follow Jesus in a world that seemed to be just ever increasingly consumed by war. I remember delivering pizzas once to some of the dorms, and it, going to one dorm room with pizzas, it was full of students having a party as they watched live coverage of America's bombing of Baghdad. It was called the Shock and Awe Campaign. And as the bombs rained down, the louder the explosion, the louder my classmates cheered. And I just thought, man, this isn't right, you know? But by the end of my time at Messiah, I was convinced that God was asking me to be a peacemaker. That is to say, I believed he wanted me to contend for the flourishing of beautiful yet broken communities, that I should spend my days seeking to cultivate shalom in places where it's painfully absent.
Can I just interject real quick? Messiah, yep. College is as an Anabaptist college, yeah, right? So these are the kind of people who would be sort of more inclined to think along sort of pacifistic or sort of peacemaking lines. And you were saying at that college, in the dorm rooms, you were having people who were cheering the Shock and Awe campaign in Baghdad?
Yes, good observation. So historically, the school was founded Brethren in Christ, so one of the historic peace church traditions, Anabaptist. I think by the time I was there, it was maybe 5-10% of the student body and staff would affiliate with one of those traditions. And so it was a very diverse group, which I love diversity and diversity of views. The U.S. is so polarized today, but back then, at the peak, at least 88% of Americans approved of the war in Iraq. So you were really looked down upon in a fighting. In fact, my junior year, for their peace week, they had a Catholic peace activist come in, John Deere, to speak in chapel. And we all met in the gymnasium and, you know, sat on the bleachers. And he started out saying something like, I think his words were, when Jesus said, love your enemies, I think he probably meant don't kill them. And I didn't think that was very controversial. I mean, I didn't grow up Anabaptist, but that made sense to me. Well, about a third of the student body stood up, began to stomp on the metal bleachers, which forced John Deere to stop speaking. And then they marched out of chapel. So it was a very polarizing time, especially if you held to a peace view. But yeah, fast forwarding to the end of college, I felt like God was calling me to move to Canada's poorest urban neighborhood in the town east side. And, you know, I felt equipped as a peacemaker. Like, I had read so many books on nonviolence and Christian peacemaking, you know, like I could quote Jesus's peace teaching verbatim. Blessed are the peacemakers, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you, bless those who curse you, do not violently resist an evil person, turn the other cheek, right? Like, I knew Jesus's peace teaching well, but it didn't take long before the messiness and the complexity of my neighborhood made me realize that I was a failure of a peacemaker. I had no idea how to apply Jesus's peace teaching in a place like that. The drugs were pervasive, the poverty, childhood trauma. So many of the First Nations people taken from their families and forcibly put in residential schools as kids. Homelessness, prostitution. And to top it all off, a couple weeks after I arrived, the jury trial began for Canada's deadliest serial killer, who we all soon learned had butchered and fed to his pigs the bodies of 49 women, mostly from my neighborhood. So it didn't take long before my neighborhood's brokenness broke me. And one day I dragged myself to church, sat down in the pew, and it turned out to be Palm Sunday. And now we get to your question, right? And I remember opening up to thought, you know, I'll just read one of the gospel accounts of Palm Sunday. And that's when I noticed Jesus's lament for the first time in the Gospel of Luke. I think maybe it was because for the first time ever, my emotions matched my Savior's grief instead of the crowd's glee. You know, it's a very dissonant scene. The crowds are shouting cheers while Jesus is shedding tears. And I've already said what that lament was. You know, Jesus cries out, if only you knew on this of all days, the things that make for peace. So why do I think that lament is central to understanding Holy Week? Well, number one, the Gospels only describe Jesus weeping twice, once when Lazarus died and this time. And so I think this lament reveals that making peace was at the forefront of Jesus's mind as he entered his final days. And the passion with which he spoke those words reveals the depth of Jesus's concern for this issue. This was no trivial matter. I believe that with these words, Jesus launched a campaign for peace that consumed his final days, that each day he confronted injustice, called out oppressors, contended for shalom, and each day he sought to correct our misguided assumptions about how to go at peace. And here's why I ended up writing this book. It's because I've come to believe that Holy Week is the main stage on which we get to see Jesus enact all of his previous peace teaching. You know, I desperately needed to see Jesus apply his peace teaching so I could have ideas of how to apply it in my context. And that's the beautiful thing about Holy Week. Formerly abstract principles like be merciful, they find concrete expression. And those lofty ethical ideals like love your neighbors, they become grounded in actual events.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about that because the way you often hear people interpret, you know, like, for example, love your enemies, turn the other cheek, it's divorced from the context of how Jesus actually lived and how the Paschal week actually went. But if you read like First Peter, he makes that connection very explicit. He says, we're following in Christ's footsteps when we love our enemies, when we turn the other cheek, when we suffer rather than return violence for violence. Yeah. So that's a profound point that we actually see Jesus live out that teaching on Holy Week.
Yeah.
Well, and you mentioned before we leave Palm Sunday, there's a couple of details that you point out that having some significance. So I just want to maybe just take a couple minutes to talk about those. The palm branches and the donkey. What's the significance of the palm branches and what's the significance of the donkey?
Sure. So let's remember the historical context of this week. We call it Holy Week. For Jesus and his followers, they were going to Jerusalem to celebrate the week-long Passover festivities, Passover being that holy week to remember the time that God liberated his people Israel from an oppressive superpower, originally Egypt. But of course, the Jewish people are once again being oppressed by a foreign superpower, this time Rome. So the Week actually had a track record of inciting all-out insurrection. And because of that, Rome in 4 BC, after one insurrection attempt during Passover, they required their provincial ruler to be in the region during Passover and to bring substantial military reinforcements. So that's what Pontius Pilate did. He left his home on the Mediterranean coast and he brought more soldiers with him and marched and had a triumphal entry into Jerusalem, coming in from the western side of the city. But Jesus, we read, and his motley crew enter from the other side. And the Gospels describe the crowds doing four things. They chant Hosanna, they quote a psalm, they lay their coats on the ground, and they wave palm branches, like you mentioned. And it means, liberate us, help us, deliver us, we pray. It's a cry for help. The Psalm 118, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. But then the crowd adds some words not found anywhere in the psalm. They declare Jesus to be their king, the king of Israel, laying coats on the ground. That probably seems strange to you and me, but back in antiquity, customary way to coronate a new king. It happens multiple times in the Hebrew scriptures, for example. And then finally, the palm branches. The palm branches were a politically loaded symbol that reminded the Jewish people of an event that took place almost exactly 200 years before. In 167 BC, the Greco-Seleucid Empire reigned over the Jewish people. And their king, one day, ransacked the temple, slaughtered an unclean pig on the altar, and sprinkled its blood throughout the temple, thus desecrating the place. Then he ordered all the towns of Judea to offer sacrifices to his pagan gods. But in the little town of Modin, there was this old Jewish priest named Mattathias who refused to comply. When one of his fellow priests relented and was about to offer a sacrifice, Mattathias lunged forward, stabbed the apostate to death, killed the king's inspector, tore down the altar, and then fled to the hills where his countrymen flocked to join him. And soon after, he lay on his deathbed, so he gathered his five sons around them. And his dying words to them were these: avenge the wrong done to your people, pay back the Gentiles in full. Well, his middle child, Judas, took those words to heart, and he launched an insurrection attempt that proved largely successful, quite surprisingly. He was so fierce in battle that his countrymen gave him the nickname Maccabeus, which means the hammer. And under his leadership, Judas, the hammer Maccabeus, he regained most of the land and most of Jerusalem. And we read in the books of 1st and 2nd Maccabees that as Judas made a triumphal entry into Jerusalem, riding a war horse, the crowds waved palm branches. And as they realized, we're likely going to get our independence back, they started to mint their own coins. And on those coins, they chose as their symbol, the definitive symbol of Israel's quest for independence, they chose the palm. And they encircled it with the battle cry for the redemption of Zion. And that symbol, we know, remained a powerful symbol of Israel's quest for independence. And after the time of Jesus, because of the Jewish-Roman wars that occur after Jesus, and once again, they thought, we're going to get our land back. And once again, they began to mint their own coin. Once again, they chose the palm as that symbol for their independence. So in other words, waving a palm branch signified a desire to break free from foreign occupation. And what's more, waving them at Jesus meant they thought he would be their liberator. So that's the significance of the palm branches. You asked about the donkey. You know, I think Jesus was not surprised. This was not the first time the crowds tried to make Jesus king by force. We read about that elsewhere in John, for example. And so Jesus came prepared. In fact, I think this is street theater at its best. So there's the symbol of riding a donkey. And thankfully, we don't have to speculate about why he chose a donkey, because John explicitly tells his readers. He says that Jesus rode a donkey in order to align himself with Zechariah's vision of a peaceable king. Zechariah 9:9, see, your king is coming seated on a donkey's colt. And the very next verse says that this king is going to remove the weapons of war, get this, from his own people. And he's going to proclaim peace to all nations. I mean, it is radical, a radical vision of this king. But it's not just the donkey, actually. The timing and the location are also important, because Jesus entered on the first day of the Passover festivities, the 10th day of the Jewish month of Nisan, which according to Mosaic law was the day where everyone was to select their Paschal lamb that they would then hold on to for 4 days. we know from historical records, the sheep are primarily supplied from Bethlehem, right? That town should sound familiar to you. And also the route that the sheep from Bethlehem would have taken to come into Jerusalem lines up with the route that Jesus took on his not so triumphal entry. And both almost certainly entered through the gate that was known as the Sheep Gate. In other words, Jesus subtly, yes, but unambiguously used this event to declare that he was not coming like Judas Maccabeus to bring a hammer down upon their enemies. Rather, instead of coming as the hammer of God, he was coming as the King of God.
Yeah, it was kind of fascinating there. You have these sort of tensions. So you have the palm branches, which sort of suggest the warlike, rebel king. But then you also have the donkey, which sort of suggests something different. But then maybe to fast forward a little bit, I don't want to spoil anything. People don't know how Holy Week ends. But you have that this sort of repeated thing that's happening throughout the week, and especially the last day or two, where people sort of keep trying to almost like coronate him as king, but they miss the point about what the kingship really is. So like there's this conversation that sort of takes place where they're arguing, the disciples are arguing with Jesus about who's going to sit in his left and his right. Mm-hmm. And then, fast forward, there's like this kind of reveal about what that actually looks like when he comes in his kingdom, and he's on the cross, he's crucified. The people who sit in his left and his right, or at his left and his right, are thieves who are crucified with him. And then there's like a crown of thorns and the purple kingly robe, right? And all of that sort of points to, and that's done to mock, but it's like there's this sort of repeated sort of gesturing, like, look, Jesus is king, but not how you think about it. And so there is this, I think, real kind of reversal of expectations, the sort of surprising coronation of Jesus as king that isn't what people think it's going to be, which is, I think, really, I was going to say a masterful stroke of literary genius on the part of the gospel writers, but I would suppose I'd say it's a masterful stroke of literary genius on the point of God who inspired the scriptures and the events. So that's Palm Sunday. There's more we could say about that, but we'll maybe just move forward a little bit. I don't want to give away everything that's in the book, but I want to make it enticing. So we got the next day, which is Monday. And I think we talked about this last week, how most of the days don't have a really cool name. So you've got like Palm Sunday and Maundy Thursday and stuff and Good Friday. And I think most of the other days are just Ash Wednesday. I think most of the other days are just called Holy something. So this is Holy Monday. Holy Monday, Holy Tuesday. Anyway. So on Holy Monday, so we have Jesus, he enters the temple, he makes a whip, he drives out the money changers and the animal sellers, those who are selling animals for sacrifice. And the story of Jesus is using that whip is regularly cited as evidence that like Jesus would support us carpet bombing children, for example, right? So why is that reading wrong? And how do you understand what you call the temple tantrum, which was kind of a funny pun?
Yeah. Well, maybe I'll start by saying Jesus did not carpet bomb any children. I know you said that tongue in cheek, but it's interesting, actually, at the very end of that passage, we usually overlook this, but children are involved. We read that rather than being carpet bombed and killed, rather, they're actually serenading Jesus with songs of praise as they come into the temple. This chapter was really important to me to discuss this event because historically this passage has been used to justify horrendous violence by the church. Augustine used it to justify violence. Even like John Calvin used it to justify violence. St. Bernard of Clairvaux used this passage to encourage the troops during the Crusades. He said, go forth and repel the foes of Christ who armed his most holy hands with a whip. Usually the logic or lack thereof goes that since Jesus supposedly hurt people with a whip, his followers can also use force. And then by classifying the whip as a weapon, we conclude that any weapon can be used, can be permissible for Christians to use, even ones that are infinitely more lethal and indiscriminate than a whip. So I really wanted to take my time and not just neutralize what for many pacifists would be a problem text, a toxic text, but I wanted to actually show how this event can advance our understanding of peacemaking, how Jesus makes peace. We don't have time to go into the whole chapter. It's one of the longer chapters, but I will say, first of all, this wasn't a temple tantrum, to kind of have that play on words, because we actually read that Palm Sunday ends with Jesus entering the temple, looking around. Something there obviously upset him. He's assessing the situation, but he doesn't respond right then and there, rather, he goes back to Bethany for the night, and he has all night to pray and think and to devise a plan. So the next day we read that Jesus goes into the temple, and once he's in the temple, he constructs something like a whip, the text says, that he uses. And so I had this middle part of the chapter, I asked the question, ask this whip people, what does the text actually say? And the key verse is John 2:15, where it says...
Sorry, it might sound okay to the audience. It's hard to tell sometimes, but it sounded like you cut out a little bit to me. The question was about what the whip... What was the question about the whip that you were asking?
Yeah, I asked the question, did Jesus whip people? Was he whipping people, or was he whipping... using the whip as a herding implement for the cattle and the sheep? The key verse is John 2:15. It's the only one that mentions the whip of the God. And in it, John writes, and making a whip out of cords, he drove them all out of the temple. And then there's a little Greek phrase, to the sheep, kai the cattle. And so first, I think it's important to note that John explicitly states what the whip is made out of. It's made out of cords is usually how it's translated in English. But the Greek is skonion, and it refers to like rushes or like wicker-like material. So when I learned this, I actually did what many millennials would do. I went to Amazon, I bought a 200-foot roll of wicker material. Then my kids and I, we watched Indiana Jones movies while we tried to construct whips, you know, good kind of Sunday school lesson for kids. And man, you know, despite plenty of time and trying multiple designs, none of my makeshift whips would have intimidated anyone. And, you know, it's interesting that John's gospel actually uses the Greek word hos, which is a little word that means to approximate something. So it's more like a pseudo whip, something like a whip, right? Made out of wicker-like material. The prevailing theory is that Jesus used the animal bedding that was laid down for the cattle and the sheep. And constructed it there. So in other words, Jesus, this is not a well-designed instrument of torture constructed by a skiled craftsman under ideal conditions with choice materials and plenty of time. You know, it's not the leather whip with the shards of glass or stone in it that we often depict. Rather, it's a makeshift pseudo-whip that Jesus assembled hastily from a limited selection of materials. And very little time. And so, you know, we actually know from historical records that such whips were used as herding implements as well. You'd actually strike the ground to make a loud noise for sheep and cattle to use. But the real, the linchpin, the real solid evidence that Jesus did not use the whip on people is in the Greek. Get nerdy for a second. That verse again, it says, and making a whip out of cords, he drove out of the temple all, then that Greek phrase, to the sheep, kai the cattle. To is like a logical connector. So usually we translate it as so. He drove out of the temple all, so the sheep and the cattle. Kai just means and. But sometimes when you want to understand the meaning of a phrase and not just a word, you look at how that construction is used throughout ancient literature. So in this case, a to noun, kai noun construction. And I'm not the only one to do this, but that sort of phrase is used 91 times in the New Testament. Now, in our English translations, the King James was the first to do this. About half of our English translations make it sound like Jesus gets full and the animals. They translate it something like, and he drove out of the temple all along with the sheep and the cattle. But about another half of the translations make it sound like he used it just on the animals. He drove out of the temple all, both the sheep and the cattle. The interesting thing is, even though our English translations are about 50-50 split on how to translate that verse, they all, for the 90 other occurrences of a to noun, kai noun phrase in the New Testament, they all translate it in such a way so that that phrase tells us what the word it modifies is consisted of, what's it made up of. In other words, what's the all comprised of in this case, universally, every time. And so those English translations that make it sound like Jesus whipped people and animals in John 2:15 are going against the way they translate all other 90 occurrences of that phrase. And what's more, there's actually 12 occasions in the New Testament Other occasions where a to noun, chi noun phrase modifies the word all, just like it does in teen. And in every one of those instances, the to noun, chi noun phrase is telling us what the all is made up of. And he baptized all, both Jew and Gentile, for example. So in other words, to interpret John's passage as having Jesus whipping people, you'd have to translate that phrase in a way it's not translated in any other occurrence, both in the New Testament and any other ancient writing of that time. So at most, that kind of neutralizes the passage. And in the book, I show that while John does not depict Jesus behaving violently with the whip, it does show us that Jesus was not passive. Jesus refused to sit idly by and do nothing in the face of injustice, especially injustice that made God look evil. And so I agree with Gandhi, who spoke of Jesus as the most active resistor of injustice in human history. And I think that's what this passage shows.
So maybe a couple quick questions on that. So I think your analysis of the sheep and the goats is 100% correct. But I had a question about the cords, the rope of cords, because I remember after I read that, I looked up the word skoinion and tried to kind of follow it through the Old Testament, the New Testament, and the kind of intertestamental literature. And it seemed to me that the word was kind of vague and sort of dependent on the context. Because I think like in Esther, there's a reference to like a skoinion of linen. In Acts, there's the ropes on the boat that are, 2732, hold on. Anyway, so it appears to be like actual ropes, right? So there, it could kind of vary a little bit, but it seemed that your main point there was that in the context of Jesus making something with what was available, it seems likely that he's using the bedding material. I mean, would it be possible? I guess there's kind of a two-pronged approach here. Even if, let's say Jesus, well, he's making a rope of quartz. What is he making it out of? So even if there's animals that are tied with rope, you wouldn't actually tie the ropes together to make a new rope of cords, right? So it seems likely the bedding is probably what's in use for the animals.
You raise a good point. So at its most basic, the word refers to rushes, reeds, akin to wicker-like material, or I don't actually know how to pronounce the word. I see it written all the time, but rattan. It's kind of a wicker-like material. It can, like you said, with the Acts passage, it can then be used to speak of ropes, but on other historians and scholars that are way wiser than I am, point out that there were actually really good records of the materials that were usually found in the temple. And usually it would be hard to explain where this sort of material came from, except for them. Because of the massive influx of people during Passover, what was normally not the case, they made an exception and animals were even sold inside the temple grounds. Have enough space. And so that's where the prevailing theory, first proposed by a Catholic scholar, Raymond Brown, has been that it was most likely the animal bedding. There's other factors too. Like even later in the week, when people are trying to discredit Jesus on Thursday night, he's been arrested. You'd think if he had acted violently that they would have pointed that out, but they don't. And in fact, later in the week, Jesus appeals to his peaceful activity in the temple. Right. So there are other factors as well, but yeah.
Yeah, well, and also, like I said, there's kind of the 1-2 punch. The question, what is it made of? And then also, what does he do with it? And there's not actually textual data that suggests that he used it on people. So that's part of the argument as well, right? There's a couple other points that I thought were sort of interesting here. How Jesus is sort of pulling back. Well, let me see here. There's stuff that's going on this day and in the temple that point back to passages in the Old Testament. So there's that passage from Isaiah, "My house will be called a house of prayer for all nations," that Jesus quotes. But then there's the other thing too, where after this event, Jesus is healing the blind and the lame at the temple. And the place is significant, right? Because you have these ritual cleanness laws and Leviticus and Numbers and according to those laws, people like that, some people like that, people who had said certain disabilities or whatever, their eyes didn't work. They had a crushed testicle comes up. those people would have been excluded from approaching the temple to sacrifice, because there was sort of this idea that you sort of brought in kind of a full or complete offering, right?
Yeah.
And the offer also had to be full or complete. And so is Jesus healing them there? Does that point to this prophecy in Isaiah 56, where Isaiah talks about those who had previously been excluded from the temple and had been excluded from God's people would one day be welcomed and receive an inheritance? There's this idea that, you know, there is this sort of ritual cleanness stuff, but ultimately God is sort of pointing forward to a day where everyone is welcomed and brought in. Do you think that's in Jesus's mind, or do you think that's in the mind of the authors of the Gospels as they're talking about giving the story?
I think both, both in Jesus's mind and later on, the writers of the Gospels are thinking of this because they explicitly have Jesus speaking a line from Isaiah 56 and also then from Jeremiah about you turned it into a den of thieves. This vision in Isaiah 56, it's, in my opinion, it is the most radical passage revealing God's gracious inclusivity of all. He says, you know, in the temple, foreigners were to be welcomed and outsiders were to be brought in. And he says that those who are normally excluded are actually to be given a name better than sons and daughters. And the part that really blows my mind in that passage in Isaiah 56 is that God does not just declare, this is how I want it to be, and then he sits back to see, will people actually do this? No, the passage goes on to say that God then is actively seeking to gather such people and welcome them into his temple, into his presence, and he expects his priests to help bring about that divine prerogative. But that wasn't the case, right? When Jesus assesses the scene on Sunday, comes back on Monday, the scene takes place in the court of the Gentiles, or as my friend Scott Bessenicker likes to call it, the court of the excluded. Here, foreigners are corralled and kept within, and there are actually large stone signs that said, if you venture beyond this court, it's punishable with death. This court was not part of the original blueprints for the temple, but rather devout Jewish men became increasingly sensitive to purity laws. And so they built this court of the Gentiles. And so, you know, we tend to focus on the whip when we talk about this scene, but it's so important to remember that after Jesus sent away the perpetrators of injustice, it made room for those who are normally excluded to be welcomed in, like you said. Mosaic Law, Leviticus 21, for example, it prohibited the lame and the blind, for example, to offer sacrifices. And David actually took it a step further and banned them from the temple. And Stanley Hauerwas actually goes on to point out that children had always been excluded from the temple. Yet here are the ones that Jesus welcomes in, healing the blind and the lame, and the children not being carpet bombed, rather are singing praises to Jesus.
Yes, so there's kind of this idea that the way that the temples had been working, those who are ritually clean, but maybe not clean on the inside, were welcome. Mm-hmm. But Jesus... Yeah. Jesus kicks those people out and he brings in those people who may not be ritually clean or, appropriate, would not be considered appropriate to come and sort of looking forward to come near to God.
Yeah.
And those people are now welcome, so that the nations, the sick, the disabled, children, people like that are now welcome in this sort of symbolic gesture. Because, the idea of exclusion was always sort of symbolic anyway. It wasn't necessarily meant to be like, well, if you're blind, there's something wrong with you. It was more about the sort of symbolic force of it. But Jesus sort of says, well, God really actually welcomes anybody whose heart is, directed toward God, and doesn't really matter. The ritual stuff doesn't actually matter as much as we think it does. Okay, so that's Palm Sunday, Holy Monday. Then we have, I believe this one's called Holy Tuesday.
Great name, right?
Yeah. So, and the main thing that we've got there is our render unto Caesar story, I did a podcast not too long ago with Doug Stewart for Libertarian Christian Podcast sometime last year, kind of going over sort of the history of interpretation of that. And you've got some good material on that as well. But maybe just kind of quickly going over that, just because those who may not be able to just pull that up real easily and are already listening to this conversation might want to know a little bit about it. What's Jesus getting at there? Because this is another one of those passages that sort of gets co-opted to suggest that Christians are supposed to be sort of on the side of power and that there's sort of this legitimacy to violent power.
Yeah, great question. Man, most of our churches, we skip over Tuesday. You know, we celebrate Palm Sunday and then go straight to Friday or at best Maundy Thursday. But Tuesday is actually the most talked about day of Jesus's life in the Gospels. It's the coverage of Tuesday is more than all the other days of Holy Week combined. So there's a lot that happens, but it starts with a series of baited questions. The religious leaders in the temple are pretty mad at Jesus for the previous day's actions. So they want to try to get the crowds to turn on him. So they ask these baited questions in hopes of being able to do that. He'll misspeak and his followers will turn on him. So the first, or one of them, is is it right to pay the annual poll tax to Caesar? Should we pay it or shouldn't we? And it's a brilliant beta question. You know, it actually, the religious leaders that came up with the question aren't the ones to ask it. And that was wise because they were actually in charge of collecting that unpopular tax. So they sent us from two groups who genuinely disagreed on the answer to that question, the Pharisees and Herodians. And they first try to flatter Jesus with some well-chosen words. They basically say, hey, we know you're a man of integrity and you're not swayed by others because you pay no attention to who they are. That Greek there is actually a Hebrew idiom that literally translates, you don't look to people's faces, is what it actually says. So if he says, hey, pay the tax, he's just discredited himself in front of the crowds. They don't want him to say that. But if he says, don't pay the tax, the religious leaders can arrest him for inciting revolt. So there's no good answer, in other words. Yet Jesus just masterfully aces their unanswerable test. So to start with, Jesus asks to see a coin. And his questioners give him a coin that has Caesar's image on it. You may remember this. And he asks, whose image is this? Well, first of all, really faithful Jews refused to carry this coin because of the Ten Commandments, the no graven images. And so Rome let them have a different coin to use. They could pay with other currency. Rome just wanted the money. They didn't care which coin you used, right? So for his questioners, the Pharisees and Herodians, to have one of these coins on them, it's already like a whoops, you didn't think before you pulled that out of your pocket. And they had brought it into the holy precincts of the temple. But then Jesus says, whose image is this? So in their opening praise, they said, you don't look to people's faces, but it places that word with a theologically more rich word. Whose image is this? And they promptly reply, Caesar. So in other words, like, you're right, I don't look to people's faces, but evidently you look to Caesar. But image, you know, it's this theologically rich concept, the imago Dei, that God's image is imprinted on each of us. So then Jesus says, gives his famous answer, right? He says, well, then give back or repay or return to Caesar what is Caesar's and give back to God what is God's. So they said, is it right to pay? And Jesus, once again, like the word face versus image, places their word pay with a different word, to repay, to return, to give back. In order to give back to someone what is theirs, you need to be able to answer the question, well, to whom does it belong? And that was the brilliance of his answer, because all faithful Jews knew that this mantra throughout the Hebrew scriptures, what belongs to God? Everything. The earth is the Lord's and everything in it, everything in heaven and earth is yours. Everything comes from you. The question becomes, well, if everything belongs to God, what's left for Caesar? It's almost like Jesus says, well, okay, this coin has Caesar's image imprinted on it. Well, give it back to him. He can keep his little coins, but you have God's image imprinted on you and you owe everything you are and have to him. You know, so later in the week, his accusers actually accuse him of opposing payment of taxes to Caesar. But the early Christians, they tended to have a slightly different answer, more along the lines of like Romans 13. So the idea of we must obey God rather than man. And so Romans 13 talks about submission to governing authorities. But in that passage, Paul brings up two taxes, new taxes that were being imposed on the Christians in Rome, and the question of should we pay it. And he does say, pay the tax to who the tax is due, to whom the custom is due. But then he gives a litmus test that basically answers the question, what do we owe? What should we give the Caesars of this world? And he says in Romans 13:8, you owe no one anything but love. And then just in case love is too ambiguous of a concept, he defines it right away. And he says, love does no harm to another. So in other words, if the kingdoms of this world ask us to do something that would harm another person, we don't owe it to them. We'll respectfully submit to the consequences. We don't owe that to them. That doesn't belong to Caesar.
Yeah, and I like what you said about the parallel images, right? Which I think is always the implicit subtext of the passage, even though Jesus doesn't explicitly say it, which is that, yeah, we are made in the image of God. So Caesar has a coin, good for him. Yeah. God has a people. And so that there's, that he's, you know, all humanity which he's made. And so those who want to sort of divide humanity and say, well, part of you, maybe your soul belongs to God, but your body belongs to Caesar. Or I think as Arlie Ermey said in there was that the Vietnam movie Full Metal Jacket. He says your butt belongs to the Marines, right? Mm-hmm. Your soul may belong to Jesus, but your butt belongs to the Marines. And so that's not actually a legitimate interpretation of this passage. Those who want to say part of you belongs to the state or the king or the president or the government, but the other part of you belongs to God, and you just have to know how to divide that line. That's not really what Jesus is saying at all.
That interpretation started with Justin Martyr, second century. He was trying to tell the emperor of his day, you don't need to persecute Christians, you don't need to fear us. And so he quotes this, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's. And then he has this line, he says, whence to God alone, God our worship, and all other things we gladly serve you being the emperor.
Yeah.
Now, here's the interesting thing. I don't doubt Justin Martyr's faith. After all, he goes on to die a martyr for refusing to give Caesar the very thing he said belonged to God alone. But Justin Martyr wasn't a Jew. He grew up in secular society and there was taught the Socratic idea of dualism,
right.
That the physical is bad and the spiritual is good. So I it doesn't surprise me that that's how he interpreted that passage. Any faithful Jew would have known the Hebrew scriptures well enough. It's just a mantra that's throughout it. Everything belongs to the Lord. And sadly, the church really latched on to Justin Martyr's language. And like Luther went on to develop a whole theology of, you know, the two kingdoms where just kind of like the movie line that you just quoted, you know, yes, there's two sets of ethics. As Christians, we follow one ethic, but as citizens of an earthly kingdom, we also follow an ethic of our nations. And there's just no way that's what Jesus had meant, his followers would have turned their back on him right then. But it says that they were in awe and amazed at what he said, actually.
Yeah. Usually people interpret Jesus as actually just sort of saying, yeah, pay taxes. And that's just a simple answer, right? But it's actually a little more complicated than that. Yeah. And I think surprisingly, Augustine is the one who gets this right. I think Augustine's interpretation of this, surprisingly, because Augustine is usually invoked to sort of support a, just war and sort of Christian allegiance to the state. But he actually interprets this passage completely correctly, I think. I'll just throw this out here, sort of as a cute remark, but there was recently a court case in the United States where it was determined that that your money that you earn doesn't actually belong to you legally because it's minted by the federal government and by the Federal Reserve. And so you're just borrowing it. And that's essentially the way Caesar saw it. You know, these are my coins. I've minted them. I've given them to you to use, but I expect them back when I request them.
Interesting.
Which would mean that if you have Bitcoin, that doesn't really count. Anyway. So that's
the moral of the story.
That's the moral of the story. Yeah. You have Bitcoin, you don't have to pay taxes on. Let me see here. I wanted to ask a little bit, because you talk about motivations here in the book, where you talk about the temple leaders, you talk about Judas, and how we sort of can paint them sort of cartoonishly as kind of, you know, mustache twisting villains. But you argued that they're maybe more like us than we're comfortable admitting. Can you go into that just a little bit?
Yeah. So the Sanhedrin were the ruling council of the Jews. They were actually appointed by Rome, could be fired and sacked by Rome. And so what Rome wanted them to oversee, the two things Rome really cared about was that they successfully would collect the tax, bring in that revenue for Rome, and maintain stability in the region. That's what they cared about, those two things. And so we read on Wednesday of Holy Week that the Sanhedrin gather in Caiaphas's home, and they are afraid that Jesus is upsetting the social order. He's getting too popular. And so we read that they say, if Jesus continues on like this, Rome will take away our temple and nation. And then after some arguing within the Sanhedrin, Caiaphas kind of takes over the meeting and he chides his counsel and he says, "You fools, don't you know that it's better for one man to die than for a whole nation to perish?" You know, I mean, the math seems irrefutable. One man is worth less than an entire nation. But what I go on into the book to show is that Caiaphas justified killing Jesus by claiming his death would prevent an even worse outcome from happening. It's the classic case of the ends justify the means. And I think we do this all the time. You know, if children need to be separated from parents to deter foreigners from flooding into our land, then so be it. If one man needs to be crucified on a cross to prevent Rome from taking over our nation, then so be it. The ends justify the means. And pastor and writer Brian Zond, he has this great line where he says something like, "One of the greatest temptations we face is to justify violent means by an imagined good end." And that's what happened on Wednesday of Holy Week. And you know, when you justify violent or evil means because of an imagined concocted future, an imagined good end result, there is no limit to the atrocities you might justify. And so, yeah, in the book, I basically try to show when it comes to Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin, we're a lot like them. We want to say they did it because they hated Jesus. They were angry that he was becoming so popular and the crowds were turning to him, but that's not the reason given. And sometimes when we read the Gospels, our temptation, we all want to identify with the people who behave rightly in the story, but sometimes the people we are most like are actually the ones we least like, if that makes it. And I think that's the case on Wednesday.
Yeah, that's good. Well, so I'm gonna jump around a little bit here because, like I said, there's a lot of information here. I don't want to give away everything. Just kind of some tasty tidbits. There was something though that I feel like most of our audience, the libertarian Christian types, are going to track pretty well with what you said so far. But there are a couple places in Fight Like Jesus where you might lose some of our more theologically conservative and especially the Reform folks. Where you seem to maybe take issue with penal substitutionary atonement. So I just have to ask, what's your beef with the gospel, Jason?
Yes, that has been the section of the book that's received the most pushback. First of all, I know you're saying it a little jokingly, but let me just...
I'll say that actually, I think, underlines the strength of what your overall point is, right? There's kind of, we're going to debate a little bit about atonement theory, but everything else is like, yeah, pretty much. I think that's a pretty strong endorsement.
Yeah. Oh, thanks, Cody. First, let me just say, you know, you said, what's your beef with the gospel? I would not equate, and I doubt you would either, atonement theories with the gospel. Atonement seeks to explain how on the cross Christ makes us one. The gospel is the good news that God, that the word took on flesh and moved into our neighborhood in order to give us life, in order to teach us how to live, in order to empower us to live that life, in order to correct our misunderstandings and misconceptions about the giver of life. Like, that's the good news. Atonement theories seek to do something very challenging. You know, to quote Brian Zond again, when it comes to the cross, let's readily confess it, but never glibly explain it. And so when it comes to atonement theories, we're entering into some mystery, some depth, and where we need some real humility, I think, to say, how do we try to explain what's happening on the cross? And so in my book, I don't actually think of myself as rejecting penal substitutionary atonement. You know, certainly the Bible has such that Jesus takes our place on the cross. There's certainly economic language. The wages of sin is death, and we often try to mistakenly make that penal, judicial, the punishment of sin is death. But there are places in the New Testament that use a little bit of a judicial or penal language there. So it's certainly a metaphor. What I tried to do, one of the things I tried to do in my Friday chapter is say, here's a line that should not be crossed when it comes to our efforts to explain what happens on the cross. Namely, we should never pit the Father against the Son. And yes, there are some who seek to espouse penal substitutionary atonement that do that. They pit the Father against the Son. But the Gospels say that it was because God so loved the world that he sent his Son, not that Jesus came to protect us from the wrath of God. Paul writes that God was in Christ on the cross, reconciling the world to himself. And so, yeah, one of the things I do in the Friday chapter is I look at that line of Jesus on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? And I say, you know, did God really forsake Jesus on the cross? And I basically give four reasons why I think that's probably not the case, but that's where penal substitution often lands. They'll say, see, God the Father had to turn his face away from Jesus because God the Father is holy and he cannot look upon sin. I think that comes from a misreading of Habakkuk 1, where Habakkuk says, God, you're holy and you cannot look upon sin. Though the next chapter, God basically says, you're right, I'm holy. I cannot look upon sin and not do something about it. You know, so we leave that last. On the cross, first of all, my theology tells me that God is like Jesus. God's not like the Pharisees. And when sinners come in the presence of Jesus in the Gospels, he doesn't turn his face from them. That's more how the Pharisees acted. Second, after Jesus says, my God, why have you forsaken me? He keeps talking to God on the cross. So either he forgot that God had abandoned him, right? Or maybe it felt like God had abandoned him. You know, even his final lines, into your hands I commit my spirit. It would be like a trust fall gone horribly wrong if God's not there. You know, he leans back to be caught by the Father in surprise. Third, that he's quoting Psalm 22. My God, why have you forsaken me? It's the opening line of that psalm. And, you know, he's suffocating on the cross. It's hard to catch a breath. We don't need to make him quote the whole psalm. Like, we should go and read the psalm ourselves. It would be like if we listen to the hymn, "Lo, in the grave he lay, Jesus my Savior," and we develop these fatalistic theologies because of it, though we never get to the chorus, "Up from the grave he arose," right? That psalm, Jesus is identifying with it or saying it. It's prophetically speaking of him. You can hold either view. It describes hand to and pierced, being thirsty, dividing up his clothing. But it goes on to say, by the time you reach the end of the psalm, for God has not hidden his face from him. Yeah, and fourth, I would just add, Jesus actually says just hours before he's crucified, Thursday night, he tells his disciples, you all are going to abandon me, not my heavenly Father. He will be with me. I will not be alone. So yes, Jesus is abandoned on the cross by the disciples, by us, not by his Father. At least that's what I argue.
Well, and to be clear, there's another kind of extreme on this, which, you know, you hear some folks who are kind of more left-leaning theologically or whatever, and they'll describe penal substitution as divine child abuse. Mm-hmm. And I think that's it's what I'm looking for, like a non-serious or a non, you know, it sort of starts by assuming the Trinity isn't the Trinity, right?
Yeah.
And then sort of reads in sort of some other kind of context or meaning into it, which also isn't fair or accurate. But yeah, there's definitely some tension. So as you said, sometimes trying to summarize it too simply or too easily or too glibly can lead us into some problems. Even if you want to argue that in some sense, Jesus is forsaken in our place, there's a lot that's going on there in the text that sort of suggests something a little more complex is happening than just that, right?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll tell you what, we're getting close to running out of time here. So I'm going to ask maybe one more question.
Okay.
And that is, you note that the criminal, the people clamor to be released, is named Jesus Barabbas, and that's not just an incidental detail. So what's the significance of his pairing with Jesus here?
Yeah, so it's Friday. Pontius Pilate presents two options for the crowds. Who should I release to you, Barabbas or Jesus? I only understand the significance of this choice if you know why Barabbas was in jail and what's the significance of his name. So as to the crime, the Gospels tell us that Barabbas was in jail because he had killed someone, murdered someone in a past insurrection attempt, likely a Roman or a Jewish sympathizer. And then to the name, you pronounced it quite well, Barabbas, right? So let me kind of put a little more emphasis on it. Barabbas, Bar-Abba. The name means son of the Father, and Matthew's Gospel gives us his full name, Jesus Barabbas. In other words, the Gospel writers, all four of them, mention this scene, thus already signifying this is significant. The Gospels present us with two rival messiahs and ask us to choose. Who do you think? Which one do you think is anointed by God? And these two messiahs, they represent two competing approaches to peacemaking. Jesus the Nazarene, who loves his enemies and refuses to kill those willing to be killed. And Jesus Barabbas, who's proven his willingness to fight for his country and kill his people's enemies. Yes, he was a failed insurrectionist, but at least he had proven his willingness to fight. And man, I think the great tragedy in the church today is that many Christians have clinging to the wrong Jesus. You know, I mean, if we approve of our country killing enemies and using force to advance its national interest, this is blunt, but I think it's true. I think it's the point the Gospel writers are trying to make. If that's what we approve of, then we've in effect chosen Barabbas and rejected Jesus. We chose the one like Judas Maccabeus, who was willing to bring a hammer down upon our enemies. And then we picked up a hammer and we nailed Jesus to a cross. Maybe one last thought. Jesus's dying words, they couldn't have been more different than Mattathias's dying words. Remember when I told that story at the start? Since the wrong done to your people, pay back the Gentiles in full. But Jesus revealed a different way. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Mattathias's dying words sparked a violent revolution, and I think Jesus's dying words sparked a nonviolent one.
Yeah, I was just, I don't know if you ever saw the movie Red Dawn from the 1980s, but the "Avenge Me" line made me think of the you know what I'm talking about, though. If you're familiar with the movie, you heard about it. The premise is the Russians invade like a small town or something, and then a bunch of the high school kids, their football team is called the Wolverines. They go off in the mountains and they start fighting back the Russians. Anyway, one of their dads is in like a concentration camp, and they talk to him through the fence, mm-hmm. and his last words are "Avenge me."
Yeah.
Sorry, that wasn't relevant to anybody or interesting at all. Jason, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us again. The book is Fight Like Jesus, and it is highly recommended Holy Week reading. So thank you. Thank you again for being here. I really appreciate you taking so much time to talk with us and go over all this material again.
Well, thank you, Cody. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Libertarian Christian Podcast. If you like today's episode, we encourage you to rate us on Apple Podcasts to help expand our audience. If you want to reach out to us, email us at podcast@libertarianchristians.com. You can also reach us at LCI Official on Twitter. And of course, we are on Facebook and have an active group you are welcome to join. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Libertarian Christian Podcast is a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute, a registered 501c3 nonprofit. If you'd like to find out more about LCI, visit us on the web at libertarianchristians.com. The voiceovers are by Matt Bellis and Catherine Williams. As of episode 115, our audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.
Hello everyone, it's Doug from the Libertarian Christian Podcast. You might notice already that this recording sounds quite a bit different from usual. In fact, it probably sounds pretty crappy. Well, I'm doing this to show you something pretty amazing. As you might know, the guys over at Podsworth Media have been producing my show for several years, quite a while, hundreds of episodes. And now they have a brand new online app for taking rough recordings like this one and making them sound a whole lot cleaner and a lot more listenable in just a few easy clicks. So here are some of the core features. They remove background noise. It reduces plosives, which is really handy for me because I often forget to put my pop filter on before I do a YouTube video. Because pop filters look terrible when you're on camera. It fixes clipping. It removes clicks and pops. It fixes clipping. It removes clicks and pops. It evenly levels dialogue so that you don't have somebody talking really quietly. And then somebody talking really loud because they're too close to the mic or too far away from the mic. It evenly levels dialogue so that you don't have somebody talking really quietly. And then somebody talking really loud because they're too close to the mic or too far away from the mic. How do you use it? It's easy. You go to podsworth.com, you click get started. And because you're a listener to one of the Libertarian Christian Institute's podcasts, you can get 50% off your first order by entering the promo code LCI50. That's LCI50. And you will get 50% off your first order. If you are doing anything like a podcast, a video, a sermon, an audiobook, anything that's spoken word, you want to use podsworth.com and clean up your audio to be even more professional and polished. You want to use podsworth.com and clean up your audio to be even more professional and polished.